Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. And I am here today with a very special guest. He is the writer and editor, Lewis Lapham. He was the editor of Harper's Magazine from 1976 to 2006, with a brief interval between 1981 and 1983, which he drifted to other things. He was then the founding editor of Lapham's Quarterly, which he still runs today. He is the author of many books, including most recently a reissued edition of his classic Money and Class in America. Also, his essay collection out from Verso, Age of Folly, which collects a number of his writings over the course of the past 20 years, and the delightful book, Lapham's Rules of Influence, a careerist's guide to success, status, and self-congratulation, which offers a number of tips for how you, too, may succeed in the American ruling class. He is also the creator and host of what has to be one of the most delightful and strange documentaries ever made, which is the film The American Ruling Class, which a friend introduced me to. And it's, I do not know how to describe it to people, because there are all sorts of wonderful, it's just to give a little preview, you will see Howard Zinn giving a trolley tour.
But today I have the opportunity to introduce Professor Howard Zinn, who's on board with us. He is going to tell you some things about the American Revolution that you did not learn in history books. So Professor Zinn, here is the microphone.
Suppose we take a left turn here and we can talk a little about Shay's Rebellion.
You will see Pete Seeger singing a song. You will learn many things about the American ruling class. Wonderful, delightful, strange film.
In a world collaterally damaged by the magic of money and the miracles of science, no questions get asked more often than the ones about the uses of America's wealth and power. To what end the genius of the Wall Street banks and the force of the Pentagon's colossal weapons? Where does America discover the wisdom to play with its wonderful toys? The questions touch on the character of the American ruling class. And if they're hard to answer, it's because we like to pretend that no such thing as a ruling class has ever darkened an American shore or danced by the light of an American moon.
Lewis Lapham, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure, Nathan. A pleasure. I look forward to it.
If people don't know your background, much of your writing focuses on, well, your film is called The American Ruling Class, the inner lives of the American elite. You were sort of born into the American elite. Your great-grandfather was co-founder of Texaco. Your grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco. You sort of have moved through the upper crust of American society throughout your life. You went to Yale and Cambridge. And it's sort of what you've written about. Sociologists often lament that ethnographies have focused too much on the lives of the poor at the expense of not looking enough at the lives of the rich, who are a fascinating subject in and of themselves. I want to start with your kind of early life, being born into this world of the American upper crust. Do you remember when you first began to see the social milieu that you were in as strange or unsettling? When you began to take on this kind of perspective of being someone who saw it kind of from the outside, from a distance, and to whom things that for other people were normal were to you quite odd?
Well, let me say that as the son, grandson, and great-grandson in a family owning oil and shipping companies, I was welcomed at birth into the hospitality tent of gift-wrapped humbug that shelters bourgeois privilege from the rain that raineth every day. Like Caesar's Gaul, a humbug divided into three parts. One, money ennobles rich people, corrupts poor people. Two, money in sufficient quantity entitles its possessor to the reverence and respect owed to the statue of George Washington. Money, three, money is the sacred elephant always in the room, never to be addressed or seen, but whose will is done on earth as it is in heaven. I mean, the message didn't come engraved on a silver tray. It was to be inferred by the weight of the silver tray. Whether in polite company or home alone with the children, my parents never discussed money. Vulgar mention of the sacred was blasphemy. Money was best left unmolested and unknown. What Plato would have recognized as the noble falsehood that provides a society with its self-preserving myth. The children of the city must be told that the God who made all of them mixed gold into some of them, who are therefore entitled to rule because they are the most valuable. Whether the intel is true or false doesn't matter. What matters is the children of the city doing their duty to believe it, to know what their rulers would have them know in order to maintain the health and well-being of the body politic. At the age of 4 in 1939, I had no reason to ask whether the intel had been fact-checked. The house was well supplied with silver trays. The picture windows afforded handsome views of the bay. The servants knew their place. I began asking questions at prep school and college in Ivy League, Connecticut in the 1950s, and then as a newspaper reporter and magazine writer resident in Manhattan in the 60s and 70s. And I caught frequent enough sight of the elephant on the golf course and the beach, at the Council on Foreign Relations, at fundraising dinners on Park and Fifth Avenues to mark its divinity as overrated and overpriced, a naked emperor clothed in the magnificence of my own stupidity and fear.
You write a lot about the kind of falseness or self-delusion that exists among this class of people. You know, when you write about some of your observations of students at Yale in the 50s, and how, you know, the wealthiest students wore, you know, deliberately sort of wore rattier clothes intentionally, yeah, or affected this air of carelessness. You know, I had a similar kind of observation when I went to Yale Law School, and it was very, very bizarre, the lack of discussion of what everyone sort of knew to be true, this sort of hiding of people's motives. I know that when you did the interviews with the Wall Street law firms, you were never supposed to even hint that you wanted the job because it paid well. You had to be very, very careful. You had to come up with these elaborate constructions of why you would want that kind of job that wouldn't involve the money. The same is true with the application essays to the law school. You could never say, I would like to come to Yale Law School because I would like to get a well-paying job that will set me up for life. You had to, you know, profess your devotion to the public interest. Because even though it was quite obvious that one of the primary reasons you would want to go to law school and why you would ever want to take one of those jobs would be that the job pays really well.
Yeah, right. In 1984, I think half of the undergraduates at Yale applied for work to either Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan Chase or a bank on Wall Street. But also in 1988, in the Yale dormitories, on the undergraduate, in the prides of place that had been reserved in the 60s for photographs of Dylan and Che, in 1988, the pride of place was a photograph of Donald Trump. Donald Trump was the absolute hero of the age in 1988. Picture on the cover of Playboy, picture on the cover of Time. His best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, was the first book that was published by one of the big New York publishing houses.
You know the first sentence of The Art of the Deal? I don't do it for the money.
It's the same pretense, right? I mean, it's the And that goes back to the beginning. America was not founded as a democracy. It was founded on a dream of riches. And the forefathers who arrive, Puritans who arrive in Massachusetts Bay in the 17th century, were come in search of riches, spiritual, temporal, animal, mineral, and vegetable. Within a matter of a few years, they start arguing the question as to whether money is mortal or immortal, wages of sin or proof sign of grace, proof of the good Lord's infinite wisdom, or product of a sweetheart deal with a massacred Pequot Indian. I mean, the whole idea of what is money and what it means to Americans is really the whole of our history, that argument.
Oftentimes you emphasize this treatment of net worth as a synonym for virtue and people measuring each other by what they possess.
Yeah.
But also, as we've said, this kind of denial that anyone would be engaged in selfishness or pure acquisitiveness, even though it's quite obvious. I mean, hypocrisy is the other theme of this book, this profession of noble virtue.
Yes, right. I mean, yeah. That goes back to Plato, when wealth and the wealthy are valued in the city, virtue and good men are less valued. What is valued is practiced. What is not valued is not practiced. And virtue is not practiced, but we want to pretend that it is. What's valued is wealth, and what we pretend to value is virtue. The more heavily we value wealth, the more ostentatiously we pretend to virtue. You know, the torn khaki pants and the scuffed shoes and the way our millionaires like to dress today are the way that kids were dressing at Yale in the 50s. You know, it's a pretense to virtue.
When you write about your education, you think there's another passage that I recall where you talk about how you kind of realized that there was not, in fact, an expectation of you to get a deep understanding of the humanities and philosophy, but there was an expectation that you would be able to sort of name drop the right philosophers and give the right talking points, this sort of,
yeah,
all the sort of signs of,
yeah,
of having,
yeah,
an education rather than the substance of an education.
That's right. That's what it was about. Archibald MacLeish makes a remark in the 30s somewhere where he talks about that. He says that the busts of the great Greek philosophers are stand around in the shelves of university libraries, but we're supposed to admire them as abstractions, not as living force. Liberty, we said, says MacLeish, we've made a thing to save and dug it round dead man's grave. I mean, that's not the exact quote, but it's like that. In other words, the classics become naming opportunities.
One of the other things that really comes across in Money and Class in America is this kind of deep inner sadness and emptiness that exists in the lives of the extremely wealthy. This is partially because, of course, the ceaseless desire for acquisition means that one can never have a satisfied life. But you have stories in there, like, you know, the story of the guy who told you when he asked his father sort of why he never told him he loved him, he said, "Well, I've dealt with you the same way I've dealt with the Justice Department and the IRS." And you have, you know, this story of, and it struck me, the story of the woman that you watched, you know, trying to get connected to Senator Edward Kennedy at a party, who you saw this sort of stoned, this cold, sad, like, ambition in her eyes, and you know, you talk a lot about this peculiar coldness. I think I believe you say yes about the rich have the temperament of lizards, and their indifference to other people's joy or sorrow bears comparison to the indifference of the stars in the constellation of Orion. Deeply, deeply sad world emotionally.
Well, yes, I mean, there's a wonderful line by I think it's Schopenhauer, who says that money is human happiness in abstracto, and people who cannot experience human happiness in concreto, in the concrete, in the specific, in the flesh, put their whole hearts on money. I mean, people at a certain level of wealth come to imagine that their money is their self, and therefore immortal. I mean, it's Trump saying, you know, when Trump comes down the escalator in 2015, and he says, essentially, he stakes his claim to the candidacy for the president on the fact that he's really rich, and he says the money is power, and power is not self-sacrificing. Democracy is for losers. Because I am really rich, I can say and do whatever I want to say and do. Melville makes the same point in 1930. He says, Americans, among ourselves, we are the first people in the history of the world to make selfishness philanthropy.
Ray Dalio, the Bridgewater hedge fund manager, said the degree to which you make money is a measure of the degree to which you've given society what it wants. Part of the core of the free market philosophy is actually the making of money is a direct measure of your human virtue.
Carnegie says the same thing in The Gospel of Wealth.
Yeah,
but he also says that the amassing of wealth is idolatry. He also says that a man dies in disgrace unless he's given away all of his wealth.
Yeah, that part of it, the second half of the Gospel of Wealth, sort of disappeared from the equation. Over time, you can't have been terribly surprised when Trump became as successful as he did. I know that you had been comparing America to a vast hotel long before the Trump presidency, and so seeing a kind of hotel tycoon become the president of the United States almost seemed like the logical conclusion of the trends. And I can see why you reissued Money a Class in America, because I have to say, you know, it does not read like it was published in the 1980s, even though its references are to the 1980s. It did seem like the culmination of a trend that you sort of watched unfold.
Yes, and is still with us. We still haven't figured a way around making a god of money. I mean, until we cure ourselves of that delusion, we're going to find it very hard to figure out a way to confront the problems of the 21st century. People write books about this all the time. America in decline, what happened to democracy? What do we do now? How do we save the climate? And so forth and so on. And the people that believe in the divinity of money believe that they can buy the future. And not only McMansions and Southampton, but also world empire. People around Bush and Bush himself thought that empire could be bought. People pushing the Sanders agenda, you know, for the Build Back Better bill, are thinking that social justice can be bought. But the future can't be bought. It has to be made. It's not a commodity. I mean, the socialist is just as fixated on money as the capitalist.
That's a fascinating thing to say, because it does remind me that all of the sort of fight over the legislation is, well, are we going to have 3 billion or billion, right? All just talking about the amount, how much, rather than getting beneath that to what are we actually going to do,
right,
and how is it going to affect people's lives.
Yeah.
It's still measured in currency.
Yeah. I mean, you ask, what are the qualifications for the American ruling class, all right? My answer to that would be the same answer that Tocqueville gives, I mentioned in Rules of Influence, which is if you want to get an interview for an A berth, or for a berth on the A deck of the American ship of state, by which I mean the executive positions, not only in the corporations, but also in academia and the media and the think tanks, you have to take it on faith that you assign to money the last, best, and final word on what is done or not done on earth as it is in heaven. Tocqueville notices this in 1831 when he's traveling around in Tennessee, that the Americans, he expected a turbulent, direct, forthright, argumentative people, and he was astonished to find how good they were at the art of servility, what he calls the courtier spirit, the bowing and scraping in nine directions into the scent and wind of money. I mean, like they're like weather vanes or wind flags on sailing vessels. And he goes on to say that never, never had he encountered a people so afraid of free expression, because they're afraid of offending, of losing a scrap of advantage or a degree of self-importance. You see that all the time. I mean, I had a television show once in the 90s about books. You know, we'd have two or three authors discussing a book, and an argument was the idea. But none of the American authors would argue. I mean, in the green room, they were fierce. But as soon as the light goes on, it becomes a sort of politesse.
I'm really glad you bring this up, because there is more to the analysis that runs through your work than purely centering it around money, because you also talk about so much about the sort of elaborate social rules that have developed and that govern people's interactions with us. I don't want to give people the impression that you are, you know, your analysis is kind of like Marx or Milton Friedman, right? In fact, it's quite different.
No. I'm interested in the culture. Upton Sinclair talked about the pecuniary standards of culture that value a man's excellence by the amount of other people's happiness he can possess or destroy. I'm interested in that. I mean, I'm interested in what happens when you make your country, the culture of business and business of culture. I mean, it's an old argument. I mean, Edith Wharton makes the argument, and so does Veblen. So in part, does Tocqueville. How do we measure our happiness? I was reading a book, is a new book called The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber and David Wenrow. I found it a marvelous book. I mean, because he talks about the possibility of creating a complex society that is not based on money. And we've done it in the past. And he finds an American Indian, you know, Wyandotte, North Great Lakes, who knows this and who says this. Makes a wonderful speech about money that could have come right out of the pages of my book. He's an Indian who's been to Paris and is just appalled at how France arranges his whole society on money.
I want to return to that point you're making about the sort of lack of confrontation or the lack of ability to. This is a really interesting thing that I agree is an American quality. It's another thing that I noticed in law school that I found eerie and strange, was a kind of indirectness, a kind of unwillingness to. People never talk politics in law school. They never even talked about the law at law school. They only talked about their professors, their classes, their jobs. And I noticed this in graduate school too. People never, you know, never wanted to, never confront you directly about things. Confrontation, very strange. People don't want to be impolite, don't want to rock the boat. You've got a lot in your, I mean, the sort of rules of influence book is a lot about the people you can criticize, the people you can't, the ways in which you, the sort of delicacy that you have to navigate the social, with which you have to navigate the social world if you're going to get ahead, the way that people flatter, the way that people suppress their real opinions or real thoughts, the acceptable things to say, the unacceptable things to say.
Yeah. During the 80s and 90s, I published 8 or 9 collections of essays, and I would occasionally make book tours, and I'd find myself wherever, in Denver or Seattle or Chicago, and I expected people to argue. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was saying things that were clearly against the rules, and I expected loud argument, but nothing. I was accepted as a kind of talk show guest, you know, or a visiting celebrity, and nobody wanted to engage. And you're right. We still don't engage on the real arguments. We don't engage about, you know, why do countries go to war, or why what is the objective of our system of education, or what do we mean by democracy? You're right. The questions always come, you know, how much and if or when is the check in the mail?
And you also talk about status of these sort of these superficial markers, you know, prizes, institutional affiliations. I mentioned, yeah. I deliberately mentioned in the introduction that you left Harper's for a brief period in the 80s, because there's a story in the Rules of Influence that I think is just hilarious, where when you're invited to a fancy Council of Foreign Relations dinner and you've left your institutional affiliation, suddenly they're horrified because they don't know how you're going to qualify to be at a fancy dinner. And
yeah. You know, I cease to exist. And that's one of the differences. But there's nobody on earth that doesn't believe in, you know, like money, right? I mean, Americans are not unique in that. But what we are unique is putting so much value into it. I mean, for example, the Washington Swamp, right? The rotunda of lobbyists, politician, lawmaker to lobbyist and back again and so on. And everybody wants to stay connected to some kind of an institution. In England, people can afford to say what's on their mind. And if they lose, okay, they can go back to the country. They have another identity that is not completely entwined in their institutional identity.
One of the pieces of advice you offer in the Rules of Influence book is that you should make sure not to do a negative book review of any prominent authors. I mean, you really have to be careful not to fall out of favor, or people will turn on you instantly, and you'll be out of the proper circles.
Yeah. Well, you see what's happening. I mean, that book was written, I don't remember how many years ago, but now with what we call cancel culture, I mean, and it's just gotten that much worse. People are afraid to say anything because who knows when it's going to be used against you. There's a fine essay by Ann Applebaum in this month's Atlantic, and in which she talks, it's called The Last Puritan, and she talks about the silence that's imposed on people afraid to speak their minds, afraid to say, contradict the wisdom in office, whether it's in a university or a bureaucracy or a corporation.
I tend to be a little bit critical of some of the perspectives of those who make arguments like Applebaum's. One of the reasons is because I think it collapses some of the distinctions between who you're offending. I think there's a difference between, you know, the political correctness and...
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you wrote one of the things, you have this anecdote about, like, I think it was the time Dan Rather was going to write about critically about Richard Nixon, but then all of a sudden decided he'd be better off inside the White House than out. So, you know, there's silence because it offends, you know, corporations and the government, which is a little bit different to me than silence because it offends, you know, people who are interested in social justice on social media.
You're right. You're right. I take your point. But I'm just talking about the audible silence.
You must have seen, as a magazine editor, journalists deliberately pull their punches for career-based reasons or access-based reasons.
Well, I mean, that's the story of Rather, right? I remember I commissioned some kind of an essay. This is early on. This is in the 70s. I was the managing editor. I commissioned an essay from a Time writer on some large trending topic. And he wrote it in the last paragraph. He permitted him to say, "I think." And then when he saw it in proof, he changed it to "millions of people think." And I killed the article. Yeah.
How much does this world of data seeking, this need to constantly be focused on one's career, how much does that in publishing and journalism specifically inhibit and keep us from having the kind of rich intellectual world of books and magazines that we might have if it were driven by pure intellectual concerns rather than commerce?
Well, again, it's what pays and what doesn't pay. I mean, you don't have to work for a newspaper very long to find out which stories make page one and what your editors want to hear. So there's no room for that. There is informed and rich discussion in magazines of small circulation, but in large circulation, it's not as common.
Well, that's why I'm very proud of Current Affairs' small circulation.
I agree with you. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I went to Cambridge and the... E.M. Forster, I think, was E.M. Forster, was still alive and gave one lecture a year. And the first time, it was a regular ritual. The date, time, and room of the lecture would be posted. And 150 people would show up. And Forster wouldn't. Then it was posted a second time. And 50 people showed up, and Forster didn't. The third time, 9 people showed up. Forster walked in punctually on time and say, "Good, now we can talk."
I need to try that. I need to try that technique.
Well, you'll get the rich conversation.
I'm following. I'm gonna all the rules of influence. By the way, extremely useful, actually.
Okay. All right. Okay.
No, I was struck when I was trying to sell a book, finding out about the world of publishing and just how much what publishers buy. They don't even really care what you put in the book. They care about, you know, whether the concept of the book matches what they sense will sell at that particular moment. And if you can convince, so I wrote a book on socialism, and the reason I was able to sell a book on socialism was because it was a moment, it was a market moment that, oh, we can sell a socialist book. Once I wrote the book, they barely looked at the manuscript. They were like, "Oh, thanks for the manuscript. We'll put out the book."
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, if you make a proposal, they look up your prior track record, right? How many hits do you have on? I mean, they ask these kind of questions before they offer you an. Yeah, you know.
Oh yeah. No, they want your social media followers. How many social media followers do you have? Do you have enough to where? And then if you say, oh, I have a lot, they say, oh, well,
that's right.
You know,
no,
here's a
no, they want to find out whether you're a marketable commodity.
That's exactly it.
They don't care about the ideas.
Well, it's shameless, and there's also this sense. I mean, they put. I was pressured a little bit. I've resisted the urge to make it an autobiography, but there's this sense that because autobiographies sell better than books about ideas, you know, can you find a way to make this a story about you or about a different person? And what's frustrating is that is not done from the perspective of will this make a better book, but will this give us an easier way to sell the book?
I mean, that's always the question. I mean, we are a plutocracy, right? That's the question that gets asked. It's the price of the thing, not the worth of the thing, that is the question that we ask. And we assign to money the power of intellect and feeling and thought.
Well, it's funny. It's always funny to me that Oscar Wilde said a cynic was the person who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. But actually, a modern economist actually quite literally believes that price is a genuine measure of value.
Yes. No. We do. Right. I mean, that's how we value our baseball players and our movie stars and our, you know, handbags, our polo shirts. Right. That's the constant buying of self-esteem. Because to buy a polo shirt from Ralph Lauren, you could buy exactly the same polo shirt from an unknown sweatshop. But what you're buying is the name and the privilege of wearing that name, which is therefore enhancing your own value.
I don't know if you've read about what are called NFTs.
No, I don't know.
This is the latest development, which is even further in that direction. You essentially buy a digital file. People spend millions of dollars, and essentially they send you an image file, and they say this is yours. But the entire thing is about status. So people are spending millions of dollars on what is essentially nothing. It's air,
right?
But it's status.
Yeah, I mean that's the whole argument of Veblen in the Theory of the Leisure Class.
I did want to caution listeners that I said earlier I follow Lapham's Rules of Influence, but if they haven't read Lapham's Rules of Influence, they should know they should not follow under any circumstance the rules in Julius Lapham's Rules of Influence, because they are things like practice your lies like you practice your golf swing.
Yeah, right.
I want to finish off just by asking you, you now edit your quarterly, and for people who don't know, your quarterly, you pick a subject for each issue, and you mine the archives of history for fascinating kind of lost texts and quotations and insights from the human intellect across times and cultures. It's a really unique publication. I wanted to ask you, in the course of your mining of the past, are there one or two things that you've come across, quotations, insights that you felt like really gave a deep and profound insight into the nature of this country that you're glad you found and could share with the world?
Well, I mean, I found a number of them. I mean, I look at the past as an immense storehouse of human consciousness. Over time, and traveling across the frontiers of the millennia, men save what they find to be beautiful, useful, or true. And so, I mean, it's navigational light in the gulf of time. And I think we have an enormous amount to learn from the past. I think the past is generative. It's filled with wonders that we can use. I mean, and I've told you I'm reading the book about this new book, The Dawn of Everything. Graeber and Wenrow they're archaeologists, anthropologists, ethnographers, and they're going back into seeing what they can learn from the history of the late Paleolithic and early Neolithic, and they are finding lost civilizations that achieved a great deal of, that were not only complicated and crowded and noisy, and but also were allowed for the freedom of their citizens, were leading lives without war, you know, without Hobbes. That, to me, is enormously hopeful. I tell you what I find in the doing the quarterly. It's an excitement because I'm always learning, and I'm astonished by the power of the human mind and imagination and the wealth of its expression. So, I mean, if I'm learning to look at a painting by Goya for the first time, or if I'm learning to read for a third time a novel by Melville or Balzac, I mean, it's constantly opening doors and windows into what Will and Ariel Durant called the celestial city of the past, where sculptors still carve, musicians still sing. I mean, one of the things in giving up your whole mind and soul to money is that it shrivels your imagination. It brings it down to the abstraction of a price instead of the richness of the thing itself. That's what's remarkable about our current circumstances, is the poverty of our imagination. We haven't had a new political idea in 50 years. And the reason is because we talk about money instead of about ideas or feeling or thought, I mean, or emotion. And the reading of this book, Dawn of Everything, gives me reason to feel that if men at one time had the imagination to create a future fit for human beings instead of a future fit for machines, which is what we've got going now. But I mean, the belief in money, like the belief in technology in and of itself, is a revolution in the direction of a world made by and for machines. We have to figure out a way that making a future fit for human beings. And that is the problem that we're confronting at the moment. And the more that we look for the answer to money, the less likely we are to find it.
Well, I do like what you've said, because it's a not necessarily a hopeful, but not a hopeless note to end on. I think that's right.
No.
That's one of the reasons I think the loss of the late David Graeber is such a tragedy, because he was one of these real proud utopians who sort of looked all around as an anthropologist and found all these possibilities for the human species. Because people might get the impression from picking up and reading your books like Age of Folly, like Hotel America and Money and Class, that you are a pessimist, because so much of it is about, you know, the American democracy as theater, about hypocrisy, about selfishness and about shallowness and flattery, and but beneath that is a real belief in people and a real and a deep love of what we are capable of and of the cultural treasures that we've produced, and a disappointment that when I look at, for example, the Ivy League schools, you know, my big disappointment was, you know, you have all this, you have the world's most incredible library, you have everything here, and yet you're talking about your job, you know, your future jobs, and you think, what a waste, what a colossal waste of human potential. And it comes out of a real belief that we could be better than we are.
There's a book called Stover at Yale that was published in 1912 by a guy named Owen Johnson, and he says exactly what you just said. I mean, it's weird. I mean, to read him, I mean, you'd be talking to yourself. But it's a wonderful thing. I mean, we're doing another issue on education, and I have that passage in it from Stover at Yale, 1912. You know, it is a complete waste to spend all your time networking when you could be reading and talking. It's true. I am hopeful. I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This was a really delightful conversation that I've been looking forward to for a long time. The book, Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion, was reissued by OR Books with a new preface by the great Thomas Frank, who has been a guest on this program. And Verso Books also published Lewis Levin's Age of Folly. And people can also subscribe to the quarterly.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you.
The Current Affairs Podcast is a product of Current Affairs Magazine. If you are not subscribed to Current Affairs Magazine, visit currentaffairs.org/subscribe today and get our glorious print edition. The Current Affairs Podcast is released regularly every week on patreon.com/currentaffairs. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the premier investment bank around the globe. You have been selected among the brightest graduates in the country and among 7 overseas programs. We welcome you to our headquarters downtown and encourage you to take a stroll on the floor during your coffee break.
You have magnificent vantage points over New York.
Hey, Mike, you made it. Welcome aboard.
All our major products,
income including commodities,
global asset management,
are profitable.
You've decided to join us after all.
Each of you will be assigned a mentor from among the senior ranks of this fine institution.
Welcome to the team.
What never must change, Mike, is the belief that by doing well, one is also doing good.
Because we are the only country in the world that can responsibly and effectively project power the way we can around the world. And that is a good thing. And that is a good thing for
our wish to preserve the illusion of a classless society lends itself to the telling of a story. A story about two young men who don't know whether they want to rule the world or save it. I've placed both of them in a graduating class at Yale College, and thus in a position to win all the prizes in the great American amusement park.
Well, I've got an offer from Goldman Sachs to go and work in investment banking in New York City.
That's fantastic. Are you excited about that?
Sure, I guess.
No guess. Great career. You meet a lot of nice people, make a lot of money. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, Jack.
There are certain rules that would be useful for you to remember. First, seek out the acquaintance of people richer and more important than yourself, and don't take an interest in people who can't do you any favors. When you yourself become rich and famous, then you can collect friends in the same way that Nike collects prize athletes.
Both you gentlemen have a chance to become members of the American ruling class, and I don't see why you don't avail yourself of that opportunity.
Ruling class?
As was true in the early years of the Republic, the country is governed by a commercial oligarchy. And a citizen who cannot afford the luxury of a contrary opinion learns of necessity to dance the beggar's waltz.